Shrink Wrap Radio number 310, Stories of the Jungian Way, with Jungian analysts Naomi Ruth Lewinsky and Patricia Damery.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guests today are Jungian analysts Dr. Naomi Ruth Lewinsky and Patricia Damery, and we'll be discussing their new book, Marked by Fire, Stories of the Jungian Way. Both have been on the show before, Dr. Lewinsky on episode number 292 and Dr. Damery on episode 295. To learn more about them, please consult our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Naomi Ruth Lewinsky and Dr. Patricia Damery, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio. I should say welcome back to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, and it's so good to have you both back on the show. Naomi, you were on episode 292, and Patricia, you were on episode number 295, and you were both talking about books that you had written at that point, and now you two have collaborated on a book that we're going to be discussing today, and the title of the book is Marked by Fire, Stories of the Jungian Way. A great title, I think.
Oh, I'm glad you like it.
Yeah, I really have been enjoying this book. And I gather you two have been friends for some time, is that right?
Yeah, this is Naomi speaking. Patricia and I have known each other probably about 20 years. We have a lot of kinship in our ways of understanding our own psychology and Jungian psychology and our love for the arts and for, oh, I don't know, the natural world. What else would you say, Patricia?
Yes, and I think really our way of approaching the unconscious,
right,
and the liveliness of the world. And it's wonderful to have someone like Naomi in my life where to share it and kind of, I think of us like companion logs. We burn brighter when we're together.
That's a lovely image.
Yeah, that's a nice metaphor. I like that. Now, you two don't live physically close to one another, do you?
No. Napa, and I live in Pleasant Hill, and I have to tell you, it took me 50 minutes to get to Berkeley today because of some traffic nightmare we're all in down here. So, we have to really plan to get together and see each other, which, you know, we don't get to do often enough.
No, it's true. But it allows, what it means, I live in Napa, this is Patricia, and what it means is our relationship requires a certain intention to get together. It's not something that just happens because we're in the same building at the same time often, et cetera.
Right.
So you're about 2 or 3 hours apart from each other, right?
No, actually, it turns out to be, yes.
I'm sorry, what was it?
About an hour and a half.
Oh, about an hour and a half. So
if traffic is good.
yeah. So I can see that
the traffic gods are with us.
Now I can see that collaboration was possible. Clearly it was, since it resulted in this book. Well, tell me about the call. You know, that's an important Jungian concept. Who and how got the call to do this particular book and to have it be a collaborative effort?
Well, we had a strange thing that went on for years, and I didn't know it was a call, but it was a dream, a repetitive dream I had, that Patricia and I were in a large country kitchen cooking potatoes for the Jungians. So we're cooking root vegetables. What do you suppose that's all about? And then Patricia got a literal call
from our the publisher, Mel Matthews of Fisher King Press, who asked if Naomi and I would be up for co-editing an anthology together. And we had been thinking about this project on a little bit different line, on more of a conference or a workshop line of of Jungian memoir. But so when Mel asked us and we started talking, it became, it was like, whoa, this is the time. This is the topic.
And these are the potatoes.
Yes. Yeah. And these are the potatoes.
And it's interesting that it was, you used the word root, that it was a root vegetable.
Right.
You were making a soup of a root vegetable. And really you were, you know, as I went through the book, I really felt that you were exploring in some ways the roots of various people who had been called to the Jungian way.
Yeah, that's a nice way of putting it.
Mm-hmm. It is. And I think one of the wonderful things about doing it, and I think one of the reasons that there's a life to it, is one thing about a root is it is underground. And I think many of us who wrote these articles discovered something about ourselves in the process of doing it, even though these people are people who've really dedicated their lives to working on the unconscious and what the unconscious presents, but now this is some of what was still underground at times and in certain ways and maybe necessarily needs to be underground. So it really was a process of working with roots, underground things.
And I somehow got the impression that Jung's Red Book somehow played a role in paving the way or opening up this possibility.
Absolutely. This is Naomi speaking. I have had this idea about Jungian memoir for a long time, meaning that there's a kind of writing about the psyche, about your own personal life that includes the inner life. And I'd always thought of Jung's Memories, Dreams, Reflections as a beautiful example of that kind of memoir, even though I knew that he, you know, Anyela Yaffe had been involved in putting it together and it wasn't totally written by him. But when the Red Book came out, I had the sense of, oh my goodness, here it is. Here is the quintessential going down into the depths of the unconscious and revealing that and struggling with it so openly and so vulnerably. I was incredibly moved. And as I say in my piece in Marked by Fire, I've had a long kind of struggle with Jung because he often kind of is critical of the artist and kind of puts the artist down and thinks the artists aren't trustworthy. And that, you know, and I had felt a split in me between the analyst and the poet. And when I saw the Red Book, I thought, this guy is a magnificent painter and an incredible poet. And he had to kind of hide that part of himself and put on a suit so he could look like a respectable citizen and get taken seriously. But, you know, I felt vindicated, and I felt like the two parts of myself coming together when I saw the Red Book. And so Patricia and I chose some of our favorite quotations from the Red Book to kind of be like the yellow brick road that takes you through the book.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I was reading your essay, as a matter of fact, just last night in preparation for this. Not just in preparation for this, but because I found the various essays so compelling. So just to recapitulate what you've just said, both the Dreams, Memories, and Reflections and the Red Book were intensely personal explorations and revelations. And so that's sort of what I gather you invited people to engage in. Tell us a bit about the process of getting the essays, you know, how you decided who to invite. And I was wondering where I don't recall if they were all Jungian analysts. I know a lot of them were.
There are two who are not officially analysts, that they are teachers at Pacifica.
Uh-huh.
When this is Patricia, and when Naomi and I sat down and decided, yes, this is what we wanted to do, we thought about authors that were able to write personally. We didn't want something that was intellectual or that came from the head, but one we really wanted to work with people who, with their work who we thought would be able to write in this way. And we really feel lucky. You know, the people we selected were able to do that. And we're a very lively group of people.
And most of them are people who are known to us in one way or another. In my case, I knew both Dennis Patrick Slattery and Robert Romanishin when I taught at Pacifica in the 90s. And I knew them both as being able to write very compellingly at a personal level. And they have influenced so many people who are interested in Jung and depth psychology over the years. We really wanted to have a representation of Pacifica people there because they have done an enormous contribution to the field. And then, you know, we were just sort of pleasantly surprised by so many other people that, you know, like our colleague Jean Kirsch, who can be she's very smart and she can be very intellectual, but she happened to give a talk to the membership of the San Francisco Institute that was so beautiful and so personal about the I Ching and how it helped her figure out that she wanted to marry her husband, Tom Kirsch. We were just delighted by it.
Yeah.
It's such a delightful essay.
You know, you mentioned Pacifica, and perhaps we should just pause for a moment here to let you give a little promo for Pacifica, because I think there are probably people in my listenership who dream of becoming more Jungian, getting more education, more training, looking for a graduate program, looking for an undergraduate program that at least would not be hostile to that orientation. And as you know, that can be difficult to find. So just say a little bit about what your perception of Pacifica is.
Well, I think it's changed since I was teaching there, you know, maybe 12 years ago, but or no, more than that, 20 years ago, I'm afraid. Goodness. But it's really it's a wonderful program. It's really, I have a friend who had a dream about a Jungian chocolate cake. I think Pacifica is Jungian chocolate cake. It's so rich. It's so dense. It's so delicious. And people who go there, you know, often people who want to change careers in midlife and do something with more depth. And it's arranged so that you go once a month for a weekend session, and people get intensely connected to each other and develop deep friendships. And the professors are just amazing. I mean, the two people in this book are just amazing people and thinkers and feelers. So I recommend it highly. I've known a lot of people who've gone to Pacifica, and it's really it changes people's lives in the way that the essays in this collection, people talk about how their lives were changed. Their lives changed in some dramatic way, and then they had to find depth psychology or Jung.
Yes, I've interviewed, I think, probably several people who've taught at Pacifica.
This is Patricia. I think there are a number of people that come out of the depth program at Sonoma State University and go on for their PhD at Pacifica.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
I've known several. My experience with those students is they truly are seekers. And many of them are, you know, there is a creativity in the way that they're approaching the natural world, the unconscious society. So I think it's a very lively place.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, and I just want to say something about that. It's kind of brilliant the way that a man like Robert Romanishin changed the way dissertations go. You know, when you have to get a PhD in psychology, you usually have to do something quantitative. If you're lucky, you can do something qualitative. Well, Robert talks about your relationship to your dissertation as a transference and a countertransference to the
yes.
material, and you're allowed to write about your experience in relationship to the material in that way, which, of course, is so profoundly psychological, but not mm-hmm. something I've ever heard of another program you can do it.
Mm-hmm. Now, is Pacifica in Santa Barbara?
It's in Carpinteria, which is just a little south of Santa Barbara.
Okay, and it's strictly a PhD program, is that right?
No, it's master's programs as well.
Okay, great. Okay, well, that's enough of a free plug for Pacifica. I would be happy to have them come on as an advertiser.
But in the absence, you should, absolutely.
Yeah, in the absence of that, we'll continue on. So, So I gather everybody that you invited came through, or was it hard to get some people to participate?
It was not hard to get people to participate. I think almost everybody. There were some people we asked that just did not have the time to do it. Mm-hmm. And there was one person that deselected himself. But for the most part, it was really, people were delighted by the opportunity to do it and felt a little challenged by it. This would be something that felt like it was exactly what they wanted to do.
Well, that's great. Now, certain themes, I thought, run through the stories as I was reading them. Patricia, you mentioned the seeker, and certainly that's a theme that just runs right all the way through. And
yes.
I thought other themes that kind of leapt out at me was the idea of the call, the wounded healer, shadow, and sort of the pain that sometimes is involved in the going deeply down within oneself and confronting shadow material. In fact, one of the authors used a phrase that I liked a lot, baptism in the mud.
Uh-huh.
And also the pivotal role of dreams for many of the writers. There was an absent father or mother theme, and certainly the theme of the spiritual quest. And I thought, rather than have you tell the stories here and us going through, you know, one or two or three or all of the articles trying to touch on the highlights, we don't want to demotivate people from getting the book and enjoying that for themselves. So I thought instead maybe we could focus on some of those key themes in terms of your own two lives on each of these themes. So if you'd be willing to do that, I'll sort of try to prompt you along those lines.
Okay.
You want to start, Patricia?
Sure.
Tell us about the call for you, Patricia, of what, you know, how did you get called to this Jungian work in the first place?
I think that that one of the things I started out when I was in college, majoring in chemistry and math, and I did it for really wrong reasons. I was able to score very high on my college placement in those areas, and I wanted to succeed. And at that time, what you do with that is teach. And so I spent a year when I was 21 years old teaching chemistry and math in high school, and I just hated it. I was a terrible teacher. I think many 20-year-olds, I don't think there's too many gifted teachers who are 21 years old. I think
right.
many teachers learn how to teach, but mm-hmm. I didn't even want to learn. I knew this was not the path for me. And so I think the first thing was that the call came in what I didn't want to do. I knew that I wanted to live my life in a way where I wanted to do the extra reading. I wanted to love the material, and I knew that I was done with chemistry. I had loved it when I was studying it, but I didn't want to know more about it particularly. And so I read a book at the time, and this was 1970, by Carl Rogers on what he called student-centered learning.
Yes.
And I wrote to him and I said, I'd like to go to a graduate school that uses this approach. And he kindly sent me a letter with a list of schools, and he starred Sonoma State University and the Humanistic Psychology Program as the top choice on that. So I quit my job. I packed up my car and I drove to California.
Yeah, wow.
And in that program, we were introduced to a lot of different so-called cutting-edge approaches to the psyche and psychology. And one of those was, that was when I first heard of Jung. And saw a movie, a BBC interview with him.
Oh, yeah.
And as I say in my article, it was really very boring, but it caught my eye. I still remember it. there was so much else going on that was very exciting, but in comparison, this interview was not sparkly. But then the second thing happened, which is it was a real tragedy. My roommate was killed in a bicycle accident, and her friend gave me Man and His Symbols, which was very popular and I think had either been just printed or reprinted at that time. And I loved it. And from there, I went to Memories, Dreams, and Reflections. And that was my entry, mm-hmm. my call.
Yeah. Naomi, tell us about your call.
Well, I was called by a dream and a synchronicity. I was a young mother of three kids, really lost in life, but I didn't really know that yet. And I had a very frightening dream. In the dream, my three-year-old daughter's head was severed from her body, and I heard my mother's voice say, "You'll never get her together again." And I thought, oh, my God, something terrible is going to happen to my baby. I was scared. I was, you know, it was one of those dreams that just kind of filled me with dread and walked around with me the rest of the day and the next day. And synchronistically, right at that time, my close friend's mother invited my close friend and me to come to a conference called The Forgotten Feminine. I had no idea what that meant, but something about it tugged at me. And, you know, I loved my best friend and her mother, so I went along to this conference, which was in Wheeler Auditorium at Berkeley, where I'd sat listening to lots of English professors when I was an undergraduate. And here were these beautiful, mature women who were Jungian analysts. I wasn't quite sure what that meant, but they were Jungian analysts. And they were talking about their women patients' dreams and their women patients' issues and how women would get stuck in their lives and their dreams would help them find their creativity. And suddenly, in the middle of this, I realized that dream was not about my daughter. That dream was about me. I was in serious trouble, and I turned to my friend's mother, who was seeing some Jungian, and I said, "Who's that guy you're seeing?" And that's how I tumbled into a Jungian analysis, which saved my life.
Oh, my goodness. That's a great story. And important dreams play such a big role in so many, first of all, in Jungian analysis generally, but in each of the stories of the analysts in your book, I think in most of them there was one or more pivotal dreams.
Right. Yes.
Patricia, I wonder if there is a dream that stands out. I know you've probably been tracking your dreams now for 30 years or so.
Right.
Is there one that was pivotal for you in your development as a Jungian?
Yes, there's one that I wrote about in my article about that I had probably, I'd made the appointment with my Jungian analyst, but I had not yet met with him. So I really consider it the first dream of my analysis, mm-hmm. which is always important. By the way, when people come in, usually that first dream can be a roadmap in a major way.
Yes.
But in the dream, which I had at a hot springs, the short version of it is there was this, I was being pursued. There was a war, and the grandmother and grandfather's bodies were there, and I was trying to escape the police, and I realized the way to escape was to surrender or to die. And at that point, I did. I was shot, and I died. And then I was at a wedding, and I was a man, and I was marrying this beautiful woman who had an iridescent blue snakeskin neck and this huge sensuous body. And we were being given things to reconstruct our life by our families, and all I needed was a Manitou, which in the dream was like a huge black penguin-like bird. And as we were driving out, I saw one in the cliffs. Now, for me, the first thing about this dream was that I had no idea what a Manitou was. And when I started looking it up, I found out it was really, it's really undefinable in our Western European knowledge, but it was, it is like that light, enlivening spirit in all things. And so I think that that dream is one that I have returned to it several times. It was never analyzed in my analysis, nor by anyone else. And so it was a dream that was really left to me to have to live and stay curious about. That was the benefit of that, really, as much as I wanted somebody to tell me what it meant. And I think it did reflect the problems that I was entering analysis with, that over-evaluation of intellect and a masculine way of approaching the world. And I worked on that. That was one of the first things I worked on in my analysis. But now I see, as I wrote this, I realized, whoa, this is a lot of where I am now in terms of this working to find the Manitou for the reconstruction, that unity of all things, the living spirit that is in all of us and in all creation. And so I think that one thing about a big dream, and many of these people in the book talk about big dreams, is it's a kind of spiral effect. You cycle back through it, and every time you go through it, it has a whole nother level of meaning. And it truly is one of those large dreams that provide roadmaps. So that was a big dream for me. I've had others, but that has been a really big one.
Yeah, yeah. And I can really relate to that idea of discovering the meaning or new levels of meaning, I should say, as time has gone by. And who knows, there may even be other levels that will unfold.
I know.
As time goes on. And I had an experience actually that I shared with my listeners in a recent kind of autobiographical episode that I did, in which just very recently I got an insight into a big dream that I'd had a long time ago. And suddenly it just made a kind of sense that it couldn't have made at that time.
Wow.
But with the passage of time, I suddenly saw, you know, oh, this is what that dream was commenting on much later.
Yes.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
It is.
Well, let's talk about the shadow. That's not an easy thing to talk about. But, Naomi, what can you tell us about your own struggle with learning from in relation to shadow material?
Well, I think it was encapsulated in that dream that I shared when my mother's voice said, "You'll never get her together again." Now, my mother was a good mother and a loving mother, but she was shadowy for me growing up because she was my father's handmaiden. And she just took, you know, it was a European marriage and my father was the patriarch, and she wrote, you know, she typed up his manuscripts for his great studies, and I didn't want to be my mother. And of course, in those days, everybody who walked into my office said they didn't want to be their mother.
Yes.
So mother, though she was in many ways very positive, was also very negative for me. I did not want to be my mother. I didn't want to be depressed and not live my own life. I didn't want to have my head and body severed in the way that they were in that dream. My daughter's head and body were severed. And I really had to struggle with that. And, you know, when you and I talked last, David, we talked about the mother line. The writing of the mother line was in many ways a way of finding my way back to honor my mother and the power of the mothers, which I felt deeply in my life because I became a mother very young, and being a mother was a very positive, important part of my life. But I also needed to honor my intellect and my head and my ambition and my desire to be a serious person in the world. So I think for many women, there is a shadowy aspect, which when you go through it, you know, going through to the other side, you find something very magical. And this is a very big dream that happened to me as I was working on the mother line, and I wrote about it in the mother line. I dreamt I was with my mother in the German woods, and of course my mother came from Germany and had to flee because of the Nazis. So we're in the German woods, and it has a kind of fairy tale feeling, and we're walking and we're very companionable, and things are good between us. And we come to a spring, and my mother essentially hands me over to this very eerie creature who was maybe a fairy, maybe a goddess. She was bigger than a fairy usually would be. And she had kind of red curly hair and magical blue eyes. And she was taking me off into the dark woods, and I don't know what was going to happen. So it was going from the personal mother to an archetypal magical goddess figure who had magic properties and was going to teach me a whole different connection to the feminine than my mother was able to, because my mother is a very practical woman. Her magic is music. She's a wonderful musician. But she kind of looks funny at me when I talk about my poetry or I talk about magic or the other things that fascinate me.
What about the theme of the wounded healer? Do you feel that that there was a wound that was calling you to this work and that needed to be worked through?
Oh, my God, huge wound. I mean, what could be a huger wound than your body being separated from your head?
Right.
I mean, yes. I mean, it took 27 years of analysis, a lot of other work to work through, and many, many, many dreams and much writing. So much of the healing for me has been in the writing, and I don't know if you'd say that about yourself, Patricia, but, you know, I just feel like I have my head, I have my body, they're very well connected, they love each other, and I love them.
Yes.
But it took a lot of work.
Yes.
It took 27 years worth of work.
It took a lot of work. And, of course, it was all going in the culture at the same time, you know, with women's liberation, which was a big influence on me.
Patricia, tell us what you can about your own shadow work and your baptism in mud.
Well, one thing that happened in this dream, after I had this dream, I woke up at 4 a.m, the one about the Manitou, and I went to the hot springs and was soaking in it. And when I got up, I out of the springs, I had turned entirely black. as it turned out, the mineral that was in my water at home reacted with the sulfur in the springs, and it took 2 or 3 days to get it off. But for me, it really was a blackening. This dream was a dying to my old reality, and I went into one of the worst depressions shortly after this that I've ever had. And it lasted a year. You know, I got into my analysis, and it was safe. It was safe to fall apart. And that was, I understand depression. You know, that really, I didn't take chemicals to get rid of it. I really let myself receive what the dreams and the images and that healing interaction with my analyst. And it, so I really, for me, I know what the wound of depression is, and I know when people are depressed, I know what to do in a certain way, which is to sit with it and endure with it. And I'm not talking about organic depression. I'm talking about the kinds of depression where we go underground to our roots and listen another way to what comes.
Yeah, I think this is Naomi speaking. I think that's very important what you're saying, Patricia, because we undervalue what's underground so much in our culture, and it's so hard to sit with patients and encourage them to go down there. But if you think about root vegetables, if you think about all of our roots, they're all in the dark.
Yes.
That's the nature of where we grow from. I mean, without roots, we can't grow. And I think over and over again, I see it in my practice, and I've experienced it very often in my life, that we need to go through a kind of a dying to the old way, a dying down, like, you know, a plant dies and then the plant comes back in the spring, you know, out of the root.
Wonderful. Now, another theme that seemed to run through many of the stories was either an absent father or an absent mother. And I wonder if that played a role for either of you.
I wouldn't say that so much. I would, for me, it would probably be the presence of, I think about my mother in particular, but my father too. My mother was a big person. And she really, for me, I had to deal with separating myself from her bigness and not doing what was going to please her or what I thought would make her proud of me. And, you know, moving into psychology was not something that she understood. Once she said to me, "I don't understand your life, but it sure is interesting." And I thought that was a great concession, because, you know, until I had this dream, I really was living to please my mother in some pretty unconscious ways.
Mm-hmm. And in my case, I would not say that my father was absent. I would say that he was tyrannical, and he was brilliant. And so it was a great setup to have a major projection on Jung, which is what I write about in my piece at the end of Marked by Fire, because I write about having this big fight with Jung about his attitude toward the artists and his negativity about the artists, and how when I saw the Red Book, as I mentioned earlier, that began to feel healed in me, and I was able to do an active imagination with Jung where that got healed. But in my father's case, it never did get healed. My father was a brilliant musicologist, and I got an enormous amount, all of the family did, from his brilliance and his understanding of history and culture and his introducing us to so many things and his interest in African-American music and culture, which, you know, was one of the things that we shared as a family. It was a very rich childhood. But, you know, if I had to play the piano, because we were all supposed to play a musical instrument, and if I played a wrong note, I could hear my father running down the stairs and yelling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it sure didn't make me want to keep playing the piano, and I don't play it anymore, which is a shame because I love music.
Yeah, I was just going to ask if you ever got back to the piano.
That's, you know, if he'd been a little more absent, maybe I'd be playing the piano to this day.
Yeah. Talk a bit about the spiritual quest and the way in which either you're getting involved, becoming a Jungian analyst is an expression of that, or has opened that up for you, or just whatever relationship you have to it. Let's start with Patricia.
I think that Jungian psychology definitely has a spiritual root and opens people to spirituality, and I think it's never more evident than it is in the Red Book. I think that, and you can see the tools that he uses in working with what comes to him to process it and to have it work on him, work in the psyche. For me, I think that I have been able, through his examples, and reading, and memories, dreams, reflections, through some of his other writing, but because the Red Book came only recently, but I was really able to identify, this happened to me too, and begin to make sense and become conscious of some of my own early attempts to make sense of what was going on in my life, but also to find a way to understand some of my own early spiritual experiences. So, I do think that this dream of finding the Manitou, it's definitely a spiritual dream. It is my path is finding the Manitou. Maybe it is a larger dream too. Collectively, that is our task. Is to make contact with the unseen and the eternality of life. I think that definitely Jung offers much information about and much philosophy about how he did it and his own study of alchemy and how it happened there.
Well, I recall from our earlier interview and from your book that the land and nature have been a major vehicle for you, and that you've really honored it very deeply in your willingness to really commune with the land and commune with the plants that you're raising and growing on your property.
Yes, that is true. I mean, I think that when I first started, when my husband and I were married and I moved to Napa to this ranch, which I then fell deeply in love with, I have an experience of truly loving land. And I began to see what I can only describe as a light in the grass. I started photographing this to try to reflect on the outer what I was feeling on the inner. But I realized the beauty of the natural world just opens us in to eternal, into the eternal, what has always been and always will be. And it is my path. It is, it sustains me.
And you recall what you're seeing, Patricia, the Lumina Naturae, because he totally understood that light in the grass.
Yes, that's right.
Naomi, what about your own spiritual quest, spiritual development? You mentioned that your family had to flee Germany because of the Nazis, so I'm assuming that you grew up in a Jewish context.
I grew up in a secular Jewish, cultural Jewish family, where the religion was music.
Okay. Not a bad religion.
And, you know, the passion and the mystery was expressed in my family quite beautifully by music. Yeah. When I heard my parents play, of course, when I played, I had to be afraid of my father's wrath. And I was seeking something else. And the story I remember from my childhood is making a drawing that was of a figure of a female reaching up with her arms, and it was a very significant and moving image for me to make that drawing. And my father looked at it and he said, "Oh, what is that, a bull? It's a silly thing." And it just crushed me. It just crushed me. And of course, later, as I got into my interest in the goddess, I discovered that that is a quintessential image of the goddess. And actually, my father was onto something, because the bull is sacred to the goddess, and there's often this kind of back and forth in imagery between the feminine and the goddess, the female figure and the goddess, or the womb and the ovaries and the goddess. So, you know, there in that story, there was this sense of how difficult it was for me to claim my sacred sense of the feminine, and a lot of my work has been about that. But I also want to tell a dream that I had, which I wrote about in my essay, and I think really speaks to so much of what my spirituality has been about in my life. When I first started working in my training as a Jungian with Joe Henderson, who was one of the founders of our institute, before I went to see him, I had a dream. It was my beginning dream for my control analysis, and in the dream, I go to see Joe, and Joe has an oven, a kind of a furnace, in the middle of his office. The office has lots of bookshelves and lots of books, and in the middle there is this furnace. And Joe calls it a funda in my dream. And I had no idea what that meant, but I knew, because Joe told it to me, that the heat in the funda came from the center of the earth. Now, I walked in for my first hour with Joe Henderson in control analysis and told him this dream, and he was in his mid-80s at that point. He leapt up, terrifying me because I was afraid he was going to hurt himself, reached for a book, and showed me an image of the alchemist stoking that fire.
Sure.
And then the books. It was exactly like my dream, except it was an alchemist from the 16th century instead of Joe Anderson. And then, you know, here in this chapter, in Marked by Fire, I quoted at the top of it, from the Red Book, Jung said, "Support me, for I stagger, drunk with fire. I climbed down through the centuries and plunged into the sun far at the bottom, and I rose up drunk from the sun." So, you know, here Jung is writing about going down through the earth and down through the centuries to the bottom and finding the heat from the sun. And he's writing about a kind of Dionysian ecstasy about all of this. And that's my religion. That's my spirituality, is that passion that goes to the center of the earth or goes down through the centuries to the bottom of the sun and finds the sun and is connected in that way to the natural world, but also to this kind of ecstasy that I get into when I'm working on poetry or when I'm writing, or even as I'm talking right now, I'm feeling it. You know, you're probably hearing it.
Yeah. Well, I'm so glad that you've been so open with your own personal stories here, and it really kind of helps to illustrate the process of the book. As we wind down, I wonder if there's anything you'd like to add, either of you or both of you.
One thing, this is Patricia, one thing I would like to say is that I think that something that is remarkable through people's stories in the book is there is this joie de vivre that permeates many of the stories, even though many of these people suffered incredibly. And, you know, including absent fathers, mothers who were not able to be mothers for whatever reason. I think it, in many ways, they represent the product of what is offered through work with the unconscious and or an analysis. I think it doesn't only happen in analysis, but it happens in analysis where you get this larger view and it helps return you to the current of life. And I think that's one thing that was so wonderful. When Naomi and I got these papers, we took them to Truchas Peaks, to a conference center there in New Mexico, and we read them aloud to each other and were incredibly moved. People's life stories are there. When people's lives are lived and really lived down into their roots, there is such liveliness, and I think it helps all of us to tell our stories or to write them. I think all of us can get something from taking the everyday stuff of our lives and writing about it. It brings a consciousness that we may not notice otherwise.
Yes, thank you. And Naomi, do you have any last word you'd like to give?
Yeah, I was gonna add something, which I think that one of the strands that has been most powerful for me, not only in terms of what people wrote about, but what Patricia and I experienced together, is the strand of synchronicity. When you are truly on your path, things start happening that are these kind of meaningful coincidences that are totally out of the irrational, and they have to do, I think, with what Patricia talks about when she talks about Manitou. It has to do with everything's connection with everything else. And in some way, most of the people who wrote in this book told stories of how suddenly they would have these synchronistic experiences, and they feel sacred. They feel like they're up, you know, like the divine is saying, yes, you're on your path. And what happened with Patricia and me had to do with the cover of the book. A series of synchronicities pulled us toward a gallery in Truchas Peaks, and we met a woman who knew some of the Jungians we knew, and we were digging around among her paintings, and I pulled one out, and it just stopped my breath, and I showed it to Patricia, and we both said, Can we have that for the cover of our book? And it's that amazing image of Mary on a burro on her way on the flight to Egypt. She's wearing this beautiful color of kind of a fuchsia pink color. And above her is this kind of glowing white fire. It could be an angel. It could be a cloud. It mm-hmm. could be God. Who knows what it is? Mm-hmm. Very mysterious. It's very powerful. And it really describes precisely what people in this book were describing in their own life and in their own language.
Great. That's a great wrap-up. And speaking of synchronicity, that's going to be the focus of my very next show after this. So that's kind of synchronistic, too.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. And Drs. Naomi Ruth Lewinsky and Patricia Damery, I want to thank you both for being return guests today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed our conversation. I really recommend this book highly. So much of Jungian writing is very heady and can be quite difficult to follow. And what I love about this book is that instead of being theoretical, it's very down-to-earth autobiographical accounts by very human people who eventually became Jungian analysts. The other great thing is that each of these essays is brief enough that you can read one a night before going to bed. Or in bed, which is what I did. I like it when I can digest material in bite-sized chunks like that. And what I like about this interview that you've just heard is that we were pretty much able to mirror the process of the book. That is, you got to hear something about the personal trials and tribulations, challenges, and eventually joys of these two authors in their journey to becoming Jungian analysts themselves. Their book, Marked by Fire, is a reasonably priced paperback, and you can order it through the Amazon.com link in the right-hand sidebar on our site. The interview also marks a new technological leap, at least for me. Neither Lewinsky nor Damery were on Skype. However, I was able to use the Skype Out feature to call them on their home phones. Now, that's not particularly new, since that's how I conduct most of my interviews. But it's the first time I figured out how to call out to two phones at once because they weren't together. I think at some point Skype must have added this feature and I only just discovered it. One of the menus on Skype has an option called Start a Conversation. Then that dialogue gives you an option of adding additional people to the call. I assume whether they are on Skype or on home or mobile phones. Very cool.
Dr. Dave knows how much his listeners are inspired by the podcasts. And now there's an easy way to show your gratitude and at the same time ensure a constant stream of new in-depth interviews. You can easily make a contribution by logging on to the website and clicking on the big green donate button. Your donation will make a difference. Dr. Dave, thanks you all.
Thanks, Michael West, for that oh-so-professional promo. I do want to thank all of you who've clicked on that big green donate button and those of you who are about to do so. Yay! Here's something new in the Shrink Wrap Radio universe. It's been suggested to me more than once that I ought to put some of these interviews on YouTube, even if it means just adding a collage of changing images for the video track. I'm not sure that many of you regular listeners would prefer that over listening to it the way that you usually do, but the idea is that it might gain additional exposure for the show and bring in some new listeners. I'd love to have you check it out, though, on our first foray into this arena, and you can do so by going to www.youtube.com/eFocusGroups. Now, eFocus Groups is the name of my market research consulting, but don't be distracted by that. We'll be posting more podcasts to that channel. And when I say we, I'm not speaking in the royal we. I could not have done this without the considerable volunteer help from New Zealand listener and friend, Brandon Dennis. Brandon is a counselor in Christchurch, New Zealand, and a longtime listener, and he's brought a lot of energy to helping me get this idea off the ground. It would not happen without his considerable help and expertise. We're also exploring the idea of occasionally doing a video interview in which the guest and perhaps myself actually appear on camera. However, there will always be an audio version available because I strongly believe in audio. It's actually my favorite format for listening because I can listen on the go. And I know I'm not alone in that, especially for these long format interviews. As you might know, I was plagued by technical problems this past weekend. For a while, the most recent interview, number 309, wouldn't play. Then, in trying to fix it, there was a period in which we lost the audio player for all 7 years worth of podcasts. You can imagine my level of stress when that happened. And then I've been plagued by a minor problem with a bit of extraneous old audio popping onto the track near the end of the podcast. That's happened on 2 shows, and I'm trying to nip that in the bud. It seems to be happening when I move the episode from GarageBand into iTunes. It's kind of invisible, so it's kind of hard to troubleshoot. At any rate, I'm happy to say we've got it all back, and I think most of the problems have been resolved. You might recall my mentioning on the last couple of episodes the sci-fi ebook novel that listener and sometimes podcaster Heather Gout has made available for free on smashwords.com. And the only reason I'm mentioning it again is that I somehow found time to start reading it, and I just want to let you know I'm only a few chapters into it, and I'm hooked. She writes as well as she speaks, and she speaks very, very well. So I wanted to give it another plug here. The title is Shin, and I put a link to it in the comments area of Shrink Wrap number 308. Not this episode, but go back a couple of episodes, number 308. I have a couple of new transcripts to announce. Transcript for number 306, The Now Effect with Dr. Elisha Goldstein, which has been transcribed by Jeremy Devins. I may have announced that one before, I'm not sure, but I definitely have a new one from Renata Silecki, who transcribed number 301, The Hero's Journey and Dreams. And that one was with dreamworker Kelly Walden Sullivan, who you will recall interviewed me recently as well. And speaking of dreams and Kelly, I'm rushing to get this podcast out early because I'm rushing off to the 5-day conference on dreams that I've been promoting here. It kicks off this evening at the Berkeley Marina Hilton. And if you are within driving distance, it's probably not too late to get involved to sign up. For information, go to their website at asdreams.com. I plan to do some short interviews at the conference and will keep my eye out for some great future guests for the show.
Hi, this is Jungian analyst and author Dr. Joseph Cambray, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thanks, Dr. Joseph Cambray, who will be my guest on the next episode. More about that in a bit. First, let's listen to a few recent emails from our Shrink Wrap Radio listener community. And first, we hear from Chris in Japan, who writes, "Greetings from Kyoto, Dr. Dave. I love your podcast programs and the way you interview. I'm having a much better time with the podcast than I ever had in grad school." Thanks for that feedback, Chris. That's wonderful. He goes on to say, "I bought the app for my iPad and would really like to get the first podcast and not just the most recent 75. Any way that you can make that happen?" And let me answer that right here to say that they're all available on the website at shrinkwrapradio.com under all shows. And anybody who's interested in the older ones can either listen to them right there on the site or you can download them. Also, A number of the early shows are available on iTunes. You'll find that there are a number of listings for Shrink Wrap Radio on iTunes. And for a while I was listing our archival shows, but there was no way to mark them as different. So if you kind of if you see a lot of icons for Shrink Wrap Radio and you explore the different icons on iTunes, you'll find some of the archival ones there that you could subscribe to in that way. Chris goes on to write, might you be able to get some folks from, or to get some more folks from ITP? That's the Institute for Transpersonal Psychology in Menlo Park. Or perhaps the Integral Institute to interview on topics of transpersonal psychology and transformative methods in disciplined inquiry and integral psychology. Well, yes, I might be able to get some of those folks, and it's a nice reminder. I think you'll find some related podcasts in the archival ones that you're going to be looking for. He goes on to say it would also be great to have one from Dwayne Elgin or any scholar on the topic of the coevolution of culture and consciousness, and also evolutionary psychology. I'm also interested in how multiculturalism is applied in psychotherapy. The men's movement, Dr. Farrell would make an excellent guest, and peace psychology. He goes on to say, finally, I'm going to attempt to connect with you on LinkedIn if I can find you there. And he gives me his LinkedIn name. And actually, we did end up getting connected on LinkedIn. And he closes, Dave Sensei, Yoroshiku Onegaishimasu. You know, and I tried to use Google Translate to figure out what that meant. Now, Sensei, I know, would be Dave Teacher. And not sure what Yoroshiku Onegaishimasu means, but I assume it's some kind of closing salutation. And he signs it Chris, and he's in Kyoto/Kobe, Japan. How exciting. And I really appreciate that. And Chris, I will try to reach out to some of the people that you have suggested or the types of people. Those are good suggestions, and my to-do list is just so long in terms of potential guests that I'm not going to be able to please everybody. I have to say that right up front. Next, we hear from longtime listener, Dr. Ralph Wilson, naturopathic doctor in Washington, D.C., and he wrote to say, hi, Dr. Dave, to begin with, I was speaking with a psychologist at the VA Medical Center here in Washington, D.C., and I told her that I've been listening to your podcast, and she smiled and said she has really enjoyed your podcast herself. So I have to say that really tickles me that we're getting out to the place where, you know, where you mention it to somebody and turns out they're already a listener. You can't imagine how that thrills me. And Ralph went on to report that he was having difficulty listening to the last interview, the one with Holly Kenley, and that the player wasn't working. And so I'm happy to say we got it working. And he closes his note with, keep up the great work. Aloha from here in Washington, D.C. And again, that's Ralph Wilson, naturopathic doctor. He's got a website at naturalconnectionshealthcare.com if you'd like to check him out there. And finally, we hear from longtime Australian listener and contributor, Joan, who writes, hi, David, I hope all is well with you. Yes, it is. I've just listened to another of Natasha Mitchell's great interviews and want to call it to your attention. Her guest was Jules Evans, a very engaging speaker who explains his interest in philosophy, both from the value to his personal well-being in helping him overcome anxiety and depression, and the study of ancient philosophers to reveal historical roots of our contemporary therapies. I particularly liked his explanation of why we need to, quote, work or practice to change and improve our approaches to life. And I'm almost motivated to actually enact some constructive behaviors instead of meaning to get around to it. We all know what you mean, Joe. And then she gives a link to the 20-minute interview, and the URL is too long, but you could find it on abc.net.au. And she says, I think you will find Jewel's website can give you a fast overview of his perspective and message, and of course, details of his recent book. And you'll find that at http://philosophyforlife.org. She goes on to say, there's so many aspects of Jewel's work that I'm just sure you will be hooked by something there. Cheers from Joe. So Joe, thanks for that recommendation. And I have downloaded that the audio from that interview into my Dropbox. I find that's a really great way to snag some audio. Just download it into Dropbox, and then I can listen to it on the go by just pulling up Dropbox on my iPhone, and any MP3s that I've downloaded into it will play right away. And I find that's easier and quicker than trying to figure out how to wrestle it into iTunes and put it in a playlist and all of that. Yay, Dropbox. And yay, Joe, it's always great to hear from you. So I think that better wrap it up for today. And you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Remember that in addition to emails, you can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype. Our name is ShrinkPod. You can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-337-0622. And don't forget, you can go to the apps tab on our site for information about getting our iPhone/iPad/iPod touch/Android app, and you can contact me directly through that. And people have steadily been getting that app. Not a whole lot, but there's a steady trickle, and I'm glad to see that. And don't forget to join us on Google Plus. If you're not already a member, sign up, and then you can join us in a video hangout there. We've been having some fun with that. And also, we've now got two podcast interviews with video at youtube.com/efocusgroups. Check that out as well. Thanks to Jungian analysts Dr. Naomi Ruth Lewinsky and Patricia Damery for sharing their personal stories of their Jungian journey. And my next episode will feature an interview with yet another Jungian, Dr. Joseph Cambray, who happens to be the head of the International Association for Analytical Psychology. That's what Jungian psychology is called, analytical psychology. And we'll be discussing his very authoritative, thoughtful, and thought-provoking book on synchronicity. So I know you're not going to want to miss this one. Until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.